Hey guys, welcome aboard the USS Future Imperfect. I am one of your hosts this evening. I am Mike the Birdman, but I'm not alone as I somehow managed to get through the galaxy without dilithium. Believe me, more on that later. We will be talking about the new season of Star Trek Discovery, but I'm not alone on the bridge of this wonderful ship that I am joined with a giant cat, but I'm joined with the admiral of this fleet,
Steve Megatron Phillips.
And of course, it would not be thisweekingeek.net without the space custodian.
Oh, are you talking about me?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Because what? Because I clean up all the Discovery shit? But yes, Alex.
And of course, we bring in our longtime collaborator, friend, writer, and all-around good friendo,
Aaron Pollier. Good to be here.
So yes, guys, we are back here on Future Imperfect. We are going to be talking about Discovery Season 3 in spits and spurts as the season goes on, rather than doing a blow-by-blow, week-by-week episode analysis. We're going to probably do them every three or four episodes to give us plenty of stuff to talk about, so you have more stuff to digest. And so we have a chance to, dare I say, recover from each episode. However, though, that being said, this season has been interesting, to say the least. Definitely,
it's markedly better, but yes. but it all depends on your own personal rating system of how you rate the series. Anyway, I would say that regardless of where you were on the series beforehand, it would be hard to say that this season is not a lot better than what you had already seen.
Yeah, I mean, I am watching this as someone who, I didn't care for season one at all. Season two was kind of middling to me, but I thought it was okay. Season three's got me interested. I'm more excited to see this than I was the entirety of Picard. I like this more than season two of Discovery, but I like Lower Decks better than this. Man, there's a phrase I never thought I'd say in my life.
I watched this episode on these episodes. What is it? Wednesday or Thursday? Whenever I see it on Crave. And then I'm usually like, I'm okay. I'm like, this was decent. And each episode seems to be a little better for me than the last. And then I watch The Mandalorian a day later and go, oh, that's what a good sci-fi show is like.
Yeah, see, I'll admit that.
I mean, it's something about the...
Oh, I guess I have some weird latency, huh? I'll admit that my opinion of season one and season two of Discovery were very, very low. We're pretty rock bottom. Besides Anson Mount in season two, he was fantastic. In season three, yes, I will admit, is better than season one or two. I still do not like it.
We did it. All right, podcast over. Aaron likes these three. We don't have to talk about anything.
I like season three more. Like, at least in season three, I'm not having to like have my liver recover for 4 days afterwards, you know, on each episode. It's just like a 2 day recovery period before I can drink again.
You don't need a mouth guard to chew down on, so you won't bite your own tongue.
I don't need Xanax from watching them. But then again, there are episodes so far in season four that are Xanax worthy to me. So that's saying something, I guess.
And what about you, Steve? What have you thought so far?
It's definitely better than season one. I was not a big fan of it at all, but season two, anytime Anson Mount shows up, I'm good. And then this season, I'm trying to like. There's certain aspects I like, and then there's others I'm like, eh.
I think I might like this season a little more than you guys, if only because it's scratching my sci-fi nerd, not sci-fi nerd isn't having to make logical sense, obviously, but it's pretty much a reboot of Andromeda, Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda. It's almost all the big plot points are pretty much the same. In fact, they would be lying if they said that they weren't inspired by those early scripts that he had done in the 70s and then the eventual show that came out with Hercules in Space. And was that a good show? No. It was a terrible show. but it was a show that was on every day after school. So that's why I watched it. I would say each episode has gotten slightly better than the last. It's two steps forward, one step back. And some episodes are two steps forward, three steps back. And now nobody's talking.
And I can see that.
Sorry. That just kind of hit the collective wall there. I mean, it's no big secret. I have not been a huge Star Trek fan for the majority of the, I would argue, I think you could even put the argument for the life of this podcast and this big revitalization by CBS injecting money and ideas into this franchise with Lower Decks, Discovery, Picard, etc. Nothing has really got my loins excited outside of Lower Decks. Again, what the fuck? But season three has got me interested. And Aaron and I have been talking back and forth in one of our private Facebook chats. And he said, it's an average sci-fi show, but it's not great Star Trek. And then Alex and I were talking literally just before this show happened. We said it kind of has a feel like Stargate, and I really like Stargate SG-1. And I kind of dig that feel about this. It's like Star Trek, but the serial numbers are slightly not. It's almost like Star Trek knockoff, but occasionally something shows up that's Star Trek-ish. Yeah,
it's like somebody watched Stargate and was a fan of it, but didn't know that it was the writing that made it good.
Yeah, if you ignored the fact that they were trying to make Star Trek here, this would be on par with Andromeda or the weaker episodes of Stargate. They might still be kind of fun and goofy, but if you put it in context of this being Star Trek, it's head-bangingly bad.
I can't do it. I was going to say it's almost like Sequest, but Sequest had better episodes sometimes.
Well, Sequest too. Was far better written. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Okay. This is like, even Lex was better than. So like, there's not a whole lot. It's trying to emulate the feel of the late 90s Star Trek copycats, even though it's Star Trek in name.
Can I give you my overall really good points? Because have
comments. Yeah. Yeah. Do that.
The production of this series so far is stunning. Everything looks amazing. The landscape shots, especially in the first episode when they're filming in Iceland, the director of photography is clearly skilled. It looks beautiful. But that's about all I can say for four episodes of what I've actually enjoyed and marked down as, wow, I'm impressed.
Okay. I would say
landscapes are amazing.
Yes, landscape is good. CG's worse this season. It's being downgraded like significantly. They realized they blew their load on the season one special effects, which again weren't that amazingly great, except for the fact that they were spending so much time rendering things and rendering farms that they ran out of money. I'm not a fan of the CGI repair robots. It looks like a cartoon. No. It looks like Roger Rabbit.
Those are canon breaking. Those repair robots are canon breaking. And because remember, they were on Enterprise before they went into the future. So Enterprise in Pike's era, before Kirk takes command, has automated really advanced repair robots that have anti-grav systems that roam around on the outside of the ship. And I guess Discovery has them now, too. And yeah, they look terrible. I'll say that there are two special effects in these first four episodes, that really stood out as terrible. One was in the first episode where the ship that Burnham is walking towards that had just crashed and was kind of on the shore, that beach kind of shot where they're looking down. You can clearly see a white line in the water that separates the real from the CGI. It's clear as day.
Somebody doesn't know how to use proper god rays and ray trace lighting for their special effects.
The second one that stood out is in the fourth episode, the one that just aired. When they go down to Trull, remember there's that fish that jumps out of the water and then starts mm-hmm. flying around. I've seen better, better CGI on what was it? Now I'm totally forgetting the name of the show, the cartoon where there's programs, they're actually in the computer and
reboot.
Thank you. There's better CG in Reboot than that freaking flying fish.
Yeah, it was kind of awkward.
Yeah, not season one Reboot, but by season three or four. Yeah. And that was, 22 years ago.
Yeah.
On a children's TV show after the Americans had pulled the budget and it was just Canada producing it and it looked better.
Which is sad.
It's shockingly bad. Shockingly bad.
Also, the entire CG effect scene with them in the mind meld of the Trill looked like bad music videos from 20 years ago.
It was cheap.
If you can't do it, don't try.
Don't. Yeah.
Find another way. You know what would have worked? A dark room with just like lights around their heads and having flashes of like bolts of electricity sort of flashing around them. That would have worked fine.
They could have also done something akin to Deep Space Nine with the Prophets.
Just kind of like a blurry kind of white background, like you're in heaven type
look. A room full of fog and white light.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, remember that episode where Ezri has to channel the murderer, in the episode where she takes the phaser rifle that can shoot through walls? And she channels one of her previous hosts, and basically, like, she could channel him in that sense too. But I mean, I get that they're saying that she's human in this one and can't channel the Trill symbiant, but there was no special effects there. It was just standing next to him.
And
let's just start with the first episode of the season before we jump all around too much.
Yes.
So the first episode, Burnham appears, somehow lands on a planet without dying.
She crashes through into the ship that Book was flying, and somehow doesn't die when
sure, lands on the very beautiful scenery. We find out 1,000 years in the future, she didn't come out at the same time as the ship. There's stupid reasons for things being totally fucked up. She makes friends with him. They go to a trade outpost that's supposed to be like Star Trek's version of like Mos Eisley,
basically.
And then at the cantina, she gets arrested, and then they escape. There's teleporting things. Then there's a slug monster that eats her. It spits her out. They find out he's an eco-terrorist, in quotes, that frees endangered species to a planet, which we never see again. And then they leave together and live together for a year while not having sex. They're very clear about that. That's a no-no.
Well, and also in that episode, they take her to an abandoned Federation space station with a Federation liaison.
There's sitting there for 40 years, every day, looking at a screen that says no signal. My God.
Yes, because his father did it, and he's not a commissioned officer, so he can't raise a flag.
They also confuse Starfleet and the Federation repeatedly in those end scenes. They are two separate things, and they constantly confuse them.
Yes. I like to call him the Apple Man because he looks like he's living inside of an Apple store. And then at the end, she somehow commissions him, even though if Starfleet doesn't exist, she technically doesn't have the authority to do so. He salutes her, and it becomes a very rah-rah, we're America, look at our army kind of moment. That's sort of the perspective of those of us that don't live in the States. That was a very pro-America military propaganda kind of moment. But they're trying to make it seem like it's like some heartfelt thing. And then it's like, boom, here's what's going to happen this season, and there's going to be stuff about the ship. And that's the end of the first episode, as far as I remember.
Yes, no, that's a very good summary. No, that you're right. I mean, I can obviously, before we started recording, I got like the venom out of my system about this episode. So I'm not going to like do my Patton impression. Let's say that.
Fair enough. But I'll say this at the end of that episode, as snarky as I was and sort of dismissive as I was when I was given my description, I watched that and went, that's a lot better than I was expecting it was going to be. So
agreed.
So you can imagine how low all of our expectations were.
And I would say it met my expectations and didn't do much more than that. But then again, I think the entire premise of the third season, which is all kind of given out in this first episode, is complete nonsense.
Yep.
It would have been, it literally would have been better for the episode to say the Federation isn't around because reasons. Literally just saying that, because reasons, and leave it at that, because everything is so counterintuitive and anti-logical. It boggles my mind.
It would have been better if they just said, it's like, what happened? Well, it's been 1,000 years. The Federation got so large that it tore itself apart from within because they weren't able to manage it. Fall the Roman Empire, whatever.
Should
and
we talk about
go from there? We would have been pissed at it, but
should we talk about the basis of the season?
Oh, yes. Let the hate flow through you. Okay,
so the basis of the season is all ship go boom, and then they're like,
because reasons.
All ships go boom, and then we're like, well, fuck that. We don't want to be a Federation anymore.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll try to be as neutral as possible here. The ships go boom because somehow dilithium becomes inert. That's what's said in this episode. Now, mind you, dilithium is already inert. That's kind of the point of why it's used inside warp cores. So that's a little weird, right? But somehow it becoming inert makes all the ships go boom because the matter-antimatter reaction in these warp cores is no longer stable. All right, well, let's ignore the fact that that's not how dilithium works in a warp core to make all these ships explode. Why would the Federation of the 3140, about when the burn happened, because the year that they appear in is 3188. And they say it happened about 100 to 120 years ago.
The fact that they don't know the exact time.
Yeah. The fact that they don't have the exact time, even though there's ships and library computers and all this information still around, no one knows. I know that's another point entirely, but why is the Federation a galaxy spanning organization at this point? Because we know a lot about where the Federation was in the early 3000s from Time Agent Daniels in Enterprise. Why is a galaxy spanning Federation still using dilithium matter antimatter warp cores when there are better things out there? Well, you might make the argument, well, none of them are as efficient. Well, if that's the case, the Borg would have been using dilithium matter antimatter warp cores, and they don't. The Borg are using subspace taps. And if you're saying that the Federation was unable to research anything more efficient than what Archer was using in the 2150s, you're crazy.
Well, didn't they already have transwarp?
There's transwarp, and you go, well, dilithium is there to power the ship. Well, again, dilithium is not the fuel source. It's a matter-antimatter warp core.
Am I wrong, but didn't Geordi work on a way to recycle dilithium?
Yes.
Yeah, reconstituting
so,
it.
So yeah. It was not... Scotty
did it in the movie with the whales.
Yeah, and it wasn't like... I don't think the idea was that it was a perpetual motion. Like, it couldn't go forever, but... You
it was enough
recycle,
to get them by.
You could recycle many, 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 many times before it's like a lithium battery. Eventually it runs out, but you could survive off of the same dilithium for like 1,000 charges or something stupid.
Yeah, and to be fair, they do say that in a later episode, I think it's in episode 3, that dilithium was running low. Okay, so you've mined it out, big deal. Do you think that Zefram Cochrane's Phoenix had dilithium, and we know dilithium wasn't on Earth? It isn't on Earth, FYI. So Zefram Cochrane's ship not only didn't have to use
Nuclear.
Warp core. It was nuclear. It was a fission reactor that powered the warp core. You don't need even matter and antimatter to produce a warp field. The Romulans use black holes. So when the burn happens, all the matter antimatter warp cores basically don't work anymore that use dilithium. Okay. Regardless of the fact that these things would probably be highly antiqued at this point, for 100 to 120 years, no one in a galaxy-spanning federation figures out, hey, remember the Romulans? Yeah, the members of the federation that we have now, didn't they used to use naked singularities to power their ships?
If they were smart, they wouldn't have set the burn at 120 years ago. They would have set it at 700 years. They should like what they should have done if they were going to keep this storyline is the act of them going into the future, that whatever battle they happened, something happened there that chain reaction caused the burn. So them going to the future to preserve the future is what ultimately doomed it.
But that would make it so they would have to go back into their past and
kill themselves and end the show.
The idea of the burn doing what it did is ridiculous in the extreme, because not only is it that, oh, the dilithium just goes inert and warp cores explode, it's only the warp cores on starships that were at warp at the time. So not only are there or should be starships that don't use a matter antimatter dilithium warp core around, because remember, this is 3060 or whatever. All the ships that were not at warp at the time are perfectly fine. And not only that, they specifically mentioned that other types of faster than light travel are perfectly usable.
They also are purposely mentioned that, like, not only can they use warp now, but they never ever figured out what caused that explosion. You're telling me that all the warp ships that exploded at that time, this is before anything fell, they're already at the peak of their technology. Not one person was able to come up with even a hypothesis as to what happened.
Yeah, it's mind blowing how dumb this is.
Now, I was just thinking, we had sort of speculated before about when I was making fun of what the ultimate reason for the burn will be and how it's probably tied to Burnham because, you know, the name and because this is the Burnham show. But I was just thinking, we had sort of talked about in one of the episodes, Tilly mentions, you know, black holes, researching, you know, as a means to power the spore drive without using Stamets. And he shuts her down because he's shell-shocked and selfish. But what if that's foreshadowing? What if that's foreshadowing that they're going to use a black hole and it connects to the spore drive and that's what blew everything up?
That's an interesting theory.
Regardless of the reason why it happens, the results are counterintuitive and...
Yeah, this entire show is going to be about the reason. It's not... They're saying it's about, you know, bringing Starfleet back. It's not. It's going to end up being bringing Starfleet back, or they're going to meet people at Starfleet, and the people at Starfleet are going to have covered up that they caused it. And by they, I mean... Not Starfleet, maybe. Well, who knows? Section 31 caused it by trying to replicate the spore drive, which had been expunged from their records.
Okay,
or maybe the parasites finally come back to roost.
Let's put it in perspective as well. You have Discovery and Burnham being like the flag bearers of the Federation, 700, 800 years after they left. So their ship is like trying to sail a trireme around the world to rebuild the late Roman Empire of 1000 AD, you know, the remnants of it in today's world.
They're trying to recreate the Holy Roman Empire.
The idea that these people know how society works or can move around in how society has developed, even understanding the technological breakthroughs that have happened over this 1,000 years almost that they've been gone, and that somehow they're the ones to build back the Federation that is 700, 800, 900 years out of date at this point, their idea of the Federation, it's beyond laughable.
Yeah. Not to mention that their universal translators wouldn't work anymore. Think about the dialects that would have changed over 1,000 years that wouldn't be able to interpret it.
No,
I'm okay with that. Because language has always been a thing on Star Trek where you just kind of go, the universal translator figures it out. I'm okay with that. The problem is that society has moved on in 900 years of the Federation growing to become a galaxy spanning government with untold millions of new species being put into it.
Are they still driving ships, even though they're using like cool looking holographic controls? Why are they still using their hands? Why isn't the ship just, you know, connected to their brain? Why are they
still using Discovery shuttles, which are there in the first episode? They're literally using Discovery shuttles still.
Laziness.
They have instantaneous transportation to anywhere they want as personal transporters, but they still use shuttles.
This show
is it to save fuel? But wait, what powers the shuttle?
So anyway, the basis of the season is nonsense, and they're going to try to explain why it happened through the burn. I totally agree, but why it happened is completely meaningless. Of why it happened, doesn't matter how it happened. A freaking hamster caused it by falling into a computer. I don't care. It does not matter. The result is so ludicrous and counterintuitive that
why did the Q over the course of the TNG era, well, at least the Q we know, went from being a malevolent force to being something that purposely tried to help humanity and the lesser species. You're telling me that they just allowed it to happen, or are they going to cop out and say the Q did it to stop something?
And it doesn't matter why it happened. The fact is that it didn't get solved within a couple days of everyone going, we'll just put different engines in our ships. Or we'll tweak the matter-antimatter engine that is 700 years out of date in an antique. Well,
they also mention that was it, time travel was outlawed? They mentioned that when she arrives.
Yeah.
So you're telling me they didn't... So time travel's outlawed. What, nobody tried to go back and stop the burn?
Well, understand that time travel being outlawed, quote unquote, is also meaningless. If you have a faster than light capable starship, which they do, you have a time machine. Also, you banning time travel doesn't mean that the people from before the ban or after the ban don't have time machines.
That's
into your time period. Literally, the first thing we see is a time traveler with a time machine coming into your time period that has the ban,
and to the point where that doesn't even surprise this person. Like, it sounds like time travelers have shown up and they just get arrested.
Who arrests them? There's no Federation.
Yeah, but like, see what I mean?
It's completely counterintuitive, and almost all of my notes for the show are it's basically the show is contradicting itself or asking you to completely turn off your brain and not ask questions. And Star Trek is not that. Star Trek is there to make you ask questions, to make you think. Star Trek is there to make you kind of try to see yourself in a different light, where this is literally just saying, look at the pretty fucking lights. I'm sorry for swearing. Look at the lights.
Swear away, honestly, if you're mad. There ain't no kids listening to this.
Look at the. I want you to feel. And who said it? That Kurtzman said, you know, the whole point of this season is to make you feel things. No, yeah, no.
He wants this to feel like Trek, and he wants you to feel hope. The show is about what Star Trek means to you and how it makes you feel. And I was like,
this makes me feel disgust.
But that's not Star Trek.
Everyone in this show has to be a complete and utter idiot to have the events come down like they are. And we'll get into season three when they go back, episode three, when they go back to Earth, because that is a shit show.
Ultimately, the bad thing here is I feel bad for lead actress Sonequa in that she seems to be having a good time doing the show. She's going to view this on her career like in 20 years as a black mark.
Because you think
the fans, they've made new fans, and there are people that are fans of the show, but if you looked at, it's not just, social media can be toxic. There's an overwhelming amount of people that are now even posting things like every episode comes out. We're three seasons in and the show hasn't gotten better. And they're starting to blame things like her acting. And it, I'll admit,
it's the creator.
She's not a good actress either.
I don't think she's a terrible one. I think she's a good supporting.
She can't
but not
lead
enough
the show.
To
no,
exactly.
She overacts. It's like she's panting, like it's so.
This
isn't well, that's why. That's why when it's that's like why she, when Anson Mount was present, it was actually good.
But it's like she's acting like she's on a Nickelodeon kids show, mocking Star Trek. She's over the top, like melodramatic. And if that's what they want out of her, fine. If that's, you know, whatever. But the scene where she's drunk, like the...
Yeah, they drug her. They drug her and she's overacting to the... And did you notice how awesome she was, even drugged out of her mind, how awesome she was in a firefight where she was taking people out with... weapons that she was not trained with.
They tried to make a funny moment as if she was Jackie Chan in the Drunken Master movies.
It was awful. It was awful.
So that's what I'm saying. I haven't seen her in anything else, so I don't have anything to compare to. She might be doing a fantastic job of what they want her to do, but she does not come across as somebody who could lead a show like this.
Well, what's funny is the and I'm not a big proponent of using this site because I think they're garbage anyway, but Rotten Tomatoes, they have the overall for Discovery. Their average tomato meter is 85% fresh, but the average audience score is 44% rotten.
I'm shocked that it's 44%.
Well, in Discovery season 3, the tomato meter says 93% fresh and 51% audience score.
And if you look at it, we talked about it before. This show had like 100% for season 1 on the tomato meter from the
critics. It's since dropped.
And it was at like 20 or 19% from viewers season 1 and at the time. And at the exact same time that was airing, the Orville season 1 came out and that number was basically reversed.
Because the Orville is Star Trek?
Yes, and then when season 2 came out, season 1 of the Orville got like let me pull it up here just as an example of this was where it seemed like there was a purposeful push by the media, like people had to have been bought with the way they were rating things, or it was a perfect storm or something.
Well, what had happened is a lot of the sites that were reviewing Discovery season 1 were on employ from CBS.
Oh, really? Oh, like part of their extended network of,
yes,
of websites.
Yeah. So it was kind of like a nudge. Hey, because like looking back at the Orville season 1, they got a 30% tomato meter and a 94% audience. And what's funny is season 2 had 100% tomato meter and 94% audience.
And if you had looked them up, a lot of the top critics that were reviewing both shows, their scores basically flipped on season 2.
Yeah.
So they completely changed their mind, but not much had changed from the writing after the first four. Like after episode 3 or 4 of the Orville season 1, they get into the groove of how they presented the rest of the show from season 1 and 2. So either they only reviewed the first 3 episodes and then said, hey, that's the show, or whatever. But yeah, like it's apples and oranges in the sense that they are two separate shows, but I bring it up because it's going to be very interesting to see this year what season 3 of the Orville is like. It's kind of amazing to me how I don't think Discovery could have come out 2 years earlier than it did and have gotten the same reviews. It was like the perfect timing for it to have come out to that kind of review and audience. I don't think the show, if you put it on a regular network, like it would, like if they had put it right on CBS other than the pilot episode, I don't think it would have lasted the season.
No. Mm-hmm. No.
So it's the epitome of good enough for streaming is what they're going for here. And it's episode 1, you know, I think we're pretty much done on that, but like it does get a little better each episode, Episode two, Michael, you said that that's sort of fresh in your memory, right? Like,
yeah, like episode two was dealing with Discovery landing in the new 930 something years in the future. And there was no Michael Burnham till the last like 2 minutes. And I felt it was one of the strongest episodes of the show. You got Saru, you got Tilly, you got Giorgio and the bad, or one of the guys from Dawn of the Dead 2004, all fighting in a bar. And it was actually legitimately really entertaining. You had some good moments with Stamets, that woman engineer who doesn't like anybody.
Reno.
And it was clever from a dialogue perspective. The idea of parasitic ice, okay, sure, I'll bite. And I was thoroughly entertained. And it proved to me one thing. The show can be led by Doug Jones as Saru. When you take Sonequa Green out of it, or I think that's her last name, Burnham, when you take her out of it, the show can survive without her. When she's on screen working with people but not overpowering them in a scene, the show works. It really can. When Michelle Yeoh works with everybody else in the scene, as we discussed before the show, Jones and Yeoh are seasoned actors who've been around the block a number of times. They know what they're doing. They can help compliment and bring up people working with the show
whenever they're not writing her to just kick everybody and kill them.
Yeah, exactly. When she's not like, I'm Section 31, I'm Empress Giorgio, whatever.
You can
like,
say Empress, I'm Empress Zod, kneel before Zod.
Yeah, see, I like Michelle Yeoh. I just hate the character. There's no reason for her to be there. And there's no reason for the characters to ever want her around because she's just a giant pain in the ass.
They keep her around for one reason. If they ever want a violent streak in the show, it's there. She's there because, to be their assassin. That's it.
In this episode, violence solves the problem. Like, you have Tilly actually trying to talk these guys out of holding them at gunpoint in episode two, right? And I wrote down, hey, that's great. This is kind of a Star Trek thing happening. But then Giorgio shows up and shit falls apart and violence has to be used. That's not Star Trek. Every time that Giorgio is basically on screen, it's not Star Trek. It's desperately not Star Trek because it's always snark or negativity or violence that is in the scene.
Giorgio is there this season to randomly go to these weird actors that we barely ever see in the show, that never spoke before, that have a couple lines, to then plant seeds of all these people she's going to take off the ship with her to make her own show.
And this is something that I noticed, especially in episode two. I didn't know who the hell Detmer was until this season. It took three seasons, to establish who Discovery's pilot is. I didn't know her name before episode two. Yeah, that's terrible.
All you really knew is that she's friends with the one other lady from the bridge, which I don't know her name. And she has an implant and she has shell shock. And that's it.
Yep.
Is it? That's her entire, there's her arc.
See, I would say like this episode is contradicted by like the third episode, is it?
Yeah.
Where we go to dinner, because is she shell shocked or is she just an asshole?
I thought it was going to be that she had like computer virus in her brains, but
PTSD.
Yeah. Because it's been a while since I saw season two, but the android, or sorry, the cyborg lady's dead, right?
Yes, well, as far as we know, she shut down and drifted into space.
Because Cyborg Lady was probably the only character that they actually fleshed out that wasn't Saru.
Like, yeah. I don't understand why this show has such an aversion to filling out its back catalog of characters. I mean, Anthony Rapp, I think that's his name, the guy that plays Stamets, he can do wonderful things when he's on screen. He brings up other people with him when he's performing. However, all he gets in his dialogue is snark, snark, snark. I'm smarter than you.
I'm smarter than you and I'm selfish.
Yeah. But when you let him breathe to be human with him and his husband, some real emotion and genuality comes out of it, but it's overshadowed by look at me, I'm so smart, blah blah blah, I'm Mr. Mushroom Man.
And his husband's sole purpose this season is to try to tell the audience why Michael Burnham is the important character of the show.
Yeah, like there's just so many things wrong. And I said this before the show too, and I'll make this point here. When the show is a true ensemble, it works. When it splits off into the side quest of Michael Burnham, I feel the show suffers. However, in the fourth episode, which aired last week, I felt that was diminished a little bit. Into the point that I'm making is she worked in conjunction with the other actress to portray the first human Trill. And I thought that was actually pretty cool. It worked because she wasn't overpowering.
But it didn't have to be her.
It didn't have
to be. Except the doctor said it had to be you because I don't want to do it.
And then
what the doctor should have been like, I'm the fucking doctor. I should be going down to help because I'm a, like if anybody, sorry.
No,
if anybody, we'll get in episode four in detail after, but just this quick point. If anybody should be going down to meet with the Trill and try to work with their doctors on how this physiology would work, it would be a human doctor that specializes in human physiology.
Agreed.
But instead he's like, no, Burnham, you're important because you're top billed, so you have to go down.
Yeah, like one of the things that, at least looking at this from a mission specialist thing, Burnham is a scientist. Your job is on the bridge, maybe doing stuff at a science station. You are not cultural expert first contact or
her
whatever.
Her job is not map out the known stars to find the other parts of the Federation now that you're on the ship. Your job, Burnham, should be what was the burn, what caused it, what could have caused it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's beside the point. So episode two, as we sort of beat around the bush, the plot line is the Discovery finally arrives. We find out later on it's been a year since Burnham was there. They crash land on a planet with ice that is a parasitic. And then we enter a Western style bar where some locals are being held up for supplies by a bunch of bandits. They end up sort of befriending them, and that causes their death. Sort of a fight happens, like you said, and they make friends with those that are there, and sort of the first bonds of maybe a new Federation, or showing that maybe some good can still come from the Federation, is there. They make it up into space and they meet Burnham. And she's like, it's been a year. This is why I got long hairs. Everybody. Let's all cry like we're unprofessional.
They were trying to launch from the surface, but the ice was keeping them down. And it was Deus Ex Michael that showed up and towed them out of the parasitic.
Okay, that's what it was. Okay. Yes. And then they all cry. Everybody cries. Everybody on the show cries. I've never seen so many people in the military cry for so many little things ever. Ever. It's one thing, like, you'd be reunited, but to them, I could see Michael crying. It's been a year. To them, it's been hours. Why are they crying? End of story.
I suppose because they all survived.
I guess, but it's so weird. Like,
didn't they fucking hate her for like a season and a half?
Yep.
Why do they suddenly trust and like her? Except for Tilly, because she's stupid.
Like, there's so many inconsistencies with the writing and the characterization. Like, sometimes you get some really good characterization moments, but they're never allowed to breathe.
Yeah. They tried to make this reveal of them and as emotional as when the Picard and crew saw what they thought was Tasha Yar when it was, you know, Tasha's daughter. And it's like, which is, by the way, the most fucked up story if you ever think about it. Like what happened with that whole storyline. But it's
good though.
Yes. Fucked up good. But it's like, okay, that's an emotional thing because people on that crew, you know, actually you know, witnessed her die, as hokey as that death was to a sludge monster. But yes, and so that was, and this didn't happen like she died and then two episodes later or one episode later she was brought back and it's like some big emotional thing. This was over the course of multiple seasons, so it was like a surprise. And the, and in the show, it, multiple years had passed as well, so that made sense. So everybody involved would have an emotional connection. This was, we'll see you there. We're right behind you. Oh, we crashed. We just spent an hour fixing the ship. Oh, she's alive. Let's cry. But you just basically went on a lunch break and we knew you were going to be alive because the suit was going to protect you.
We so, knew that we would in like, the same place.
If anybody should be crying, it would be Burnham. Only Burnham. Because Burnham's like, for all I know, they were shot another 1,000 years in the future and I'll never see them again. Okay, that's my end of episode two. Discuss.
I'm sorry for like trying. I know I have some latency here or something, and I'm sorry that I talk over you. Yeah, I don't know. Episode two, honestly, for me, out of the first four episodes, is the best one, just because Burnham's not around for most of mm-hmm. it. She does show up. Obviously, she's the best and saves everybody. There's like the parasitic ice. All right, whatever. I already said Giorgio doing violence to solve problems seems to be an ongoing motif in a lot of these episodes. I'm not a fan of that, but I really, once again, liked the photography. I really liked the set designs. I liked the visuals that they made in general. And I really appreciated Saru. The character in this episode kind of showed why he's a good commanding officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a standout moment. Otherwise, again, you have a starship that isn't designed to land, crash into a planet, crash, full speed. Remember the episode of Voyager? When Voyager crashes into a planet, what happens? It's wrecked.
It shreds the hull, yeah.
Remember Star Trek Generations?
Yeah, the ship isn't ship designed to land unless you're like a bird of prey or you have your landing gear down like Voyager.
Or you're like Voyager, yeah.
You have very special technology that lets you land on a surface. But remember, Discovery just bowls into a wrecked planet, right?
Well, remember, these are the same people that did Star Trek Beyond, where I saw the trailer and how it starts with them taking off from a planet with little pygmy monsters attacking them. And I went, oh, I'm never going to watch this, and then walked away. So these are the same people that thought that was okay.
Okay, so the ship crash lands and yet is able to take off a few hours later somehow. Yeah. And it wails into this planet and there's no casualties, really?
Well, when you get to the Enterprise D, which is, you know, more sophisticated and larger and everything else, like, and it's just the saucer section, like, theoretically it should have, you know, with all of Discovery, it should have blown it to pieces once it hit the surface.
It's these silly, let's set this up. And, you know, there should have been massive hull breaches on this ship. And as soon as it went into space, I don't care about force fields. This ship was wrecked. Yeah, you're showing later on the freaking CGI auto repair bots running around on the hull.
You mean all the R2-D2s?
Well, they look
more like Wally.
No, they look more like the Baxter Stockman's robots.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Ninja Turtle robots fix the ship with the ice. that happens in the show.
But all of its systems are good enough that by episode three, they can jump to Earth.
Yeah. So episode three, also known as the episode I was probably the most mixed on out of all of them.
People of Earth.
I'll say I despised this episode because it makes you have to completely shut off your mind and forget everything you've learned in school about science to the extent that clearly the 20th and 19th centuries never have happened because the people of Earth are that dumb.
Well, the people of Earth are that dumb and they've reverted to like 1,000 or like 1,500 years earlier racism, xenophobia, to the point where like somebody comes to talk to them and they immediately attack and
shoot could, first, ask questions later.
No, shoot first, ask questions never is now the new policy.
So I should probably say the basis of this episode is that they decide they need to go to Earth to find the Federation. So one of the big positives here is that Michael Burnham actually gives a proper star date, believe it or not. 865211.3, which actually is in the year that they are supposed to be in 3189.
Okay. And I was then shocked. they decide to be, for whatever reason, for the sake of camera shot, that they're going to spore drive in the middle of our galaxy, like our solar system, sorry. Like think that maybe they don't know what they're getting themselves into. They would perhaps spore drive, I don't know, just outside like Uranus.
Okay,
just far enough away, or like it would only take them like a minute to get here by impulse powers.
Yeah, so what Michael says is that they're worried about what Earth might think of a starship just coming in at warp, since nobody can warp around anymore, even though there's evidence that everyone still warps around. So she says we need to jump in outside of their sensor range. So, okay, hold on for a second. In the 23rd century, where she's from, we know about how far long-range sensors can go, okay? At least a few light years. This is like Kirk's time, where they can detect things a few light years away. Okay, fair enough.
And by detect things that few light years away is full on. We know exactly what it is. This isn't like this isn't like us pointing a telescope and going that speck could be something. It's like they know, they can read a signature.
So if we assume Burnham didn't listen at all to anything that was said in the first episode, she would make the assumption, hey, maybe we should jump in about 4 or 5 light years away from Earth and then come in at superluminal velocity, you know, like really close to the speed of light. So we get time dilation. So it might only be a couple days for us, but it'll be however long it takes to get to Earth. Right. So let's say that. But remember in the first episode that the guy on the space station says my sensors are really damaged and I can only see out to 600 light years away. So Burnham knows that sensors that are damaged from this time
on the outskirts of Federation space
to 600 light years.
Do they ever what planet they were on? Like, do you know what part of Federation space they were in the beginning of the season? I don't think they even remotely mention it.
Well,
it was supposed to be something prime.
It doesn't matter.
But I was going to say, like you'd think that they would go, like, the idea is this is supposed to be the fringes of Federation space. So if what they're saying is, like, this advanced technology at the fringes, the outer edge, like the frontier of Federation space can read so many light years. You're telling me that, like, Earth Prime, like, friggin', like, the center of our entire government and economy and everything doesn't have better sensors.
So I mean, worst case, if Burnham paid attention at all, she would go, oh, my damaged sensors at this time from wherever they were can read out to 600 light years. So she would go, well, we need to jump in outside of that because Earth is clearly going to have the best shit because Federation, right? But
and it's Earth. And if they landed like 600 light years away, if that was the outer reach of the Federation's sensors, they would probably have Federation ships there that they could escort them in.
So think about that. And then where do they want to jump? They jump in next to Saturn inside the solar system. And that's somehow outside of Earth's sensor range. What they assume is Earth's sensor range, even though every piece of logic would say, oh, look, today, when we launched the Voyager probes back in 1977, our deep space network was able to keep a track of Voyager 2 out past Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and it's still in contact with it today. And remember, I mean, this keeps going on, mind you, because the main bad guys are these raiders that are plaguing Earth, because Earth has shut itself off, is no longer a part of the Federation. There is no Starfleet at Earth. Earth has these amazing freaking starships, right, that have like completely disconnected warp nacelles and things like that. There's nothing like connecting parts of these ships. So it's super high tech stuff. And there's a planetary defense shield like we saw in Picard. Okay, great, cool. But they don't know what the hell's happening in their own star system, because these raiders are humans that live on Titan, a moon of Saturn. And no one knows on Earth what was going on Titan, even though literal goddamn radio can actually transmit between Saturn and the Earth easily. Because remember, the Voyager probes transmitted information back from Saturn, no problem. And you know how powerful their transmitter is? Your refrigerator light inside your refrigerator is stronger than the transmission power of Voyager.
And they launched those and monitored them with 8-bit computers that were less powerful than an original Nintendo Entertainment System.
Somehow, Earth doesn't know what's happening on Titan, a thing that you can literally point goddamn telescopes at.
And not to mention that they mentioned that it was work they were doing there that had trouble and malfunction, that they hadn't even terraformed it properly yet. And they have ships that use wireless power and all this crazy shit, but they weren't able to terraform or properly maintain what would have been one of the first outside colonies that Earth would have ever had.
Titans, like, you wouldn't think about terraforming Titan.
Yes.
But the problem is that the whole reason why this kind of like this shit happened on Titan is that they need dilithium for their power systems, meaning that they have to be using a matter antimatter reactor on Titan, which is the stupidest thing I can ever think of. Yeah. Because you don't want to have antimatter on a planet in case you lost containment. And then you suddenly have a hole in your planet.
Not to mention that if they could power it with solar power, seeing as it's still close to the frickin' sun, when like close enough that they could just have giant solar arrays up in space.
I mean, you could do that. It's not the most efficient thing. It would be better just to have a fission reactor or a fusion reactor.
Well, I'm just saying, like, there would be ways for them to have fixed their own problem, even without having to ask for help.
There would have been a way to fix their problem with today's technology. That's what's sad. There's no reason for any of these people to be doing what they're doing, the way they're doing it, without the only reason being, I need to write a story that has an antagonist, and we need to have some reason why they don't know.
And even he has to wear a Darth Vader mask, even though he doesn't need a breathing apparatus.
He's human. Like, yeah, it's insane. But regardless, so the entire basis of this episode is complete nonsense. But the two points that they try to make in this episode is, we want to go to Earth because Earth is the home of most of our crew and it means something to us. But yet we only get one scene where a whole bunch of crew go down to what used to be Starfleet Academy to basically sit around a tree that they all remembered from them being at the Academy and go, yeah, that's pretty cool. This tree's awesome. Instead of actually letting us learn anything about these characters, about their own personalities, about their own likes. As I said before the we started recording, you know, Tilly in this episode was talking about how she's sad because her mother obviously has died. Everyone she knows has died. All of her family is gone. Wouldn't it have been amazing to have Tilly go down and find like her family's crypt and lay flowers at her mother's grave as eroded in a way? And you came up with the idea of saying, hey, what, she goes into this old cemetery that's all overrun and overgrown. And yet the last thing we see is that she found her family's tomb and like crypt and the areas where all of her graves are, and they're perfectly maintained, which means that there's somebody that is still around that remembers. And that would have been this really uplifting thing. Let's see one of the other crew members cook a meal that was important to them for some of their descendants. Like, hey, I don't know if this ever got passed down to you, but I want to cook gumbo, or I want to cook matzo ball soup that you've maybe never even had,
or the,
you know, something like that, something that
the alien
lets us learn about.
I keep forgetting the name or the type of alien, the one that looks like a frog guy. Do they mention his name?
He's a Saurian.
Okay, yes. Like, how great would it have been if just one of the characters randomly went, like, they went and cooked dinner. They're like, this is what I've been talking about. This is eggplant. You know, something that they couldn't get, you know, in space. Like, and just sharing, they should be sharing the Earth culture with those on the ship that maybe have never been to Earth.
Yeah, so you have this big dropped ball there. But the other thing that they kind of do in this episode is show that there is a human that has a Trill symbiote in her. Believe it or not, I don't have a problem with this. It actually makes sense, because we know from, again, Enterprise and Time Agent Daniels, that by the early 3000s, which is like almost 150 years before this is taking place, that humans is just kind of a description. That basically Daniels, who looked human, had DNA from dozens of different races in him. That over this 1,000 years of the Federation, that there's been a great mixing of races, which great. I think that's a really cool thing. So this human has a Trill symbiote in her, and it's made to be like, oh crap, this is really fascinating. But remember, at the time, no one knew about Trill symbiotes from Discovery's time. So this shouldn't mean anything to them, right?
Wasn't it Saru that was the only one that even referenced having any knowledge?
Yeah, but why would Saru know anything?
Because he was they established that he was like a super brown-nosed nerd that when he joined Starfleet, he tried to learn as much as he could about everything. So he studied like all of the computers.
Starfleet didn't know about symbiotes. No one knew about the symbiotes.
Wait. Don't forget, the ship merged with that. The ship merged with that computer of all of the knowledge of the universe.
Yeah, and they would have transmitted that back to Memory Alpha, because the amount of data was so large that even Tilly
would take
centuries for the entire Federation.
They did not. They took it on the ship to the future.
Yeah, they did.
And
that's why the ship talks to him now.
Yes, now the ship has the ship has a computer virus, and it talks to them just like the computer holographic pilot from Andromeda. Only it's not a super project, but at least we don't know yet.
So is this computer thing evil?
No. It's supposed to be, well, not yet. I don't think they'll do two seasons in a row with evil computer.
No. Well, they're also saying that it's basically like they're referencing that episode Calypso.
Is that what Calypso is supposed to be?
Yeah, Calypso, it has the ship is abandoned. It's just kind of floating derelict somewhere and waiting for its mission or something, and it's by itself. The AI Zora, which is the same one that's talking to Saru here, is running it, and the guy the Kraft that comes aboard, much like the names of like book, he references the Vedresh, which is also referenced in the second episode by the guy trying to steal the dilithium.
So Vedresh is the Federation.
Yes.
That's what it is. So the Federation are the bad guys in Calypso. That's what it's coming off as being.
Yes. So what we're going to basically see is that season three, Discovery is going to discover that Starfleet is bad.
And then the end of the season is going to lead into that Calypso, and then we're going to take up after that? Or is it going to be how the show ends? Like, is the show just going to end entirely there?
It was implied in Calypso that Discovery had been without a crew for a long time, like centuries, if anything. So to me, when I saw Calypso, I said, well, that kind of takes all the Mickey out of any kind of plot that has threat to Discovery at all, because we know Discovery is just going to be fine in the end. Like, because at some point it's going to have to be left alone for centuries, just sitting there waiting for people while there's a war with the Federation going on.
Yeah, it's very much like Andromeda. Very much.
I want to talk two things about this, the computer issue. And it goes back. One of these things is the sphere data they didn't know about Control when they got the sphere data, so there would have been no reason why they didn't transmit it back to Memory Alpha to share.
Except that they didn't.
They didn't because of plot for some reason, right?
They didn't because of laziness.
So let's move on from that. To me, like, Control already has the information because the information would have been automatically shared back to Federation databases at the time because there was no reason not to. All right. So anyway, the computer is in episode 4 where we finally see it kind of having a personality. Saru asks the computer questions about, like, how to get the morale up with the crew. The computer is clearly malfunctioning. Remember that Saru has no idea about the events of Calypso, which are in his own future, right? All he knows is suddenly the computer is talking strange, acting like it has a personality, acting like it has emotions, and weird shit is flying up on the screen. So what does Saru do? What would any reasonable Starfleet officer do? They would report the issue to the freaking engineering team. Maybe somebody's trying to hack into the computer. Yeah. Maybe there's a giant computer malfunction. What does Saru do? Nothing.
He asks him to run a run a diagnostic on yourself, self-malfunctioning computer, instead of being like, okay, and then just quietly walking in person. And he should have walked up to the engineering lady and been like, just whispered to her, something's not right with the computer. Check it out. Because that's what you would do if you thought that somebody was watching or somebody had compromised your entire computer security system.
Because this is in a time before the M5 computer that Daystrom developed, the M5 computer. There are no self-aware computers. I'm ignoring Control for a second because Control makes no sense either. There are no self-aware computers in Starfleet or computers that even have personality. And suddenly Saru's encountering his own computer on Discovery having clear personality and acting strangely.
And he's pretending either he's too dumb to realize it or like he sort of stammers for a second to ask it again. But I don't think, does he look at the screen when all the red garbage pops up or is he facing away? I think he's facing away.
Yeah, his back is turned for a second.
I don't think he sees...
He's clearly doing something weird.
Yeah, the voice halfway through talking changes to have an accent.
And it shifts its tone repeatedly through the scene. And it's clear that he knows something is wrong because he asks it to make a diagnostic and it gives it like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. That kind of like, it was still had its personality. And remember at the end of the episode, he even talks about how maybe Discovery is here to help her own crew.
Yeah.
You know, like he just assumes that it has personality.
Yeah. And Dr. Husband goes, oh, okay, that's perfectly okay from a medical and psychological standpoint that our captain thinks that the computer on the ship is now in love with everybody on the ship and wants to keep them safe.
It's terrifying. And no one is seemingly competent enough to figure out that there needs to be something asked, like questions asked. And this is the captain.
And it's not like, at least they didn't go so far as to have him have that talk with engineer lady. Cause if he had that talk with engineer lady and her snarky ass didn't just go, what the fuck did you just say? I at least believe a couple of the characters wouldn't do that, but like I'm seriously questioning the efficacy of the doctor. He's not really good at keeping people healthy.
No.
At all. And he's like his entire report is like everybody's mental health is down. I have no plans on how to fix that.
Coloring books was brought up at one point.
It's not like we have, you know, like they don't have a counselor, okay, whatever, but like you're telling me that not one person on the medical team was a like clinical psychologist?
Well, like the lady that's the navigator should not have been put back in that position until she was of sound mind.
Yeah, you have a major concussion and you clearly, visibly to everybody, were disoriented. And then you're like, yeah, go to sick bay. And then they turn away and let her walk by herself.
And not only that she's acting like an asshole all the time. Like she clearly either is an asshole or has PTSD extreme PTSD, and no one seems to mind. Like her friend that's on the bridge doesn't really seem to care that there's her friend is acting strangely. She just kind of defends her, like saying,
she should have, like, when Detmer left the bridge, she should have stood up, turned around and said, Captain, I'm worried about her. I want to go take, you know, go with her. Then just gone with her. But no, they just literally brush her off. Yeah, go ahead. Go away. Go to sick bay.
Yeah, see, we're kind of bleeding into the events of episode 4, where a lot of this asshattery happens. But they go to Trill. They end up going to Trill in the 4th episode. And I'm just, that episode, it's called Forget Me Not. And there's actually a couple really cool things in it.
It's the episode I like the most, but I still have problems, obviously.
I like when the computer gets glitchy and gets a personality. I thought that was actually kind of nice. It reminds me of an episode that I actually wrote for Star Trek Adventures. Then there is the scene where all the former Trill hosts are kind of in the mindscape and talking to her, the new Trill. I liked that. I thought that was well done. I liked how the former hosts, their kind of memories were there, supporting her and, you know, being kind. Yeah. I really like,
you know, speak your names, that whole thing.
Yeah, that was well done. But most of the rest of the episode was awful. Awful.
It was weird. Some parts of the A plot, which was the Trill plot, was good. Some parts of the B plot were good. But it was probably 50-50. Like, and it's probably, out of all of the episodes of this season, it's the one that is probably the best ratio of good to bad in my mind.
Okay. I mean, there's, I thought the scene that had the most potential for being really cool is that dinner scene where Saru kind of invites all the officers to sit at a dinner with him. But for some reason he invites Giorgio, the person who he knows and has been told eats Kelpians, and is generally nasty to everyone that she's always around, and is unless it's Michael Burnham, and she's still nasty to everybody at the table. Why would he invite her? She does nothing except antagonize people.
He comes across as not obviously a fool, but what's strange about this is his character had been established in the last two seasons to be highly sensitive to danger. And well, highly sensitive to people's emotions.
He evolved.
And yet now he doesn't. He evolved past it and can no longer read people.
Yeah, it's awful. God, I hated that scene, because Saru was an interesting character when he had his like fear and his like the danger, Cilia and all that. That was an interesting character. Here's a character that's in Starfleet and is faced with danger all the time and is a scaredy cat, and he's always having to try to rise above that. That's an interesting character. And they took the one interesting thing from that character and removed it. So now he's just basically weird alien guy that's trying to understand humanity. Okay, fair enough. I mean, if you have good writers, that's, you can do interesting things with that, but you don't have good writers here. And yeah, now he's an asshole.
It's not that much of a stretch either. Have you seen Doug Jones? He kind of looks like an alien trying to understand people.
Doug Jones is a great actor. That's the thing.
Absolutely. Like, his work's been always fantastic.
But there's like tons of stuff that are in this with Michael Burnham that it's St. Michael Burnham. She's here to do it. She knows how to do everything and is somehow able to do it. She accompanies the Trill, the human Trill, down to Trill. And the Trill are incredible xenophobes. They're racist beyond belief. They at first say, hey, all the Trill symbiotes, these symbiotes are the basis for our entire civilization. And every symbiote that is able to make its way back to Trill, even though there's no warp, every one of them is a great gift to our society. And then they're like, so where is the Trill host? Well, we don't have a Trill host. The symbiote's inside this human. And effectively, the Trill Council there says, get the F off our planet, human scum.
Well, they one of them says we want to gut it out of her. We're gonna cut it out. One dude's like, nah, I don't think we should cut it out. And then the other lady is like, well, this is the basis of our faith, but we have never forced anybody to be separated, so we won't do it this time. You can go. And they're like, okay. And then they go for a walk. And then the one guy that's like, cut it out of her, is like, we're going to cut it out of you. And then they pull out a bunch of knives and spears. And they're like, we're going to cut it out. And then Burnham kills all of them, basically. Well, stuns them, but doesn't say that, you know, they don't mention that they were stunned until after. It looked like they were murdered because they weren't breathing.
Yeah. That whole thing. But anyway, they get the human Trill into the Trill symbiote caves, and she kind of gets thrown into the milky liquid where all the symbiotes are, and she can try to get in touch with her former hosts, like the memories of her former hosts, yeah, to get a greater connection to her symbiote, and things go wrong, right?
Yeah. So Kurtzman couldn't skip the chance to make a scene for scene, almost shot for shot copy of Minority Report. With the eyes rolling back and the white liquid. And I'm like, come on, man. Like, stop copying better movies.
So I guess this guy has to, like, have Michael Burnham go into the mindscape to save this Trill symbiote. Even though throughout all this episode, nobody except Trill have ever been able to do this. And the only reason this human Trill mix is able to do it is because there's a Trill inside of her. Now I'll make the argument that, again, human is in double, you know, big quotations, that there's been a lot of genetic mixing by this point.
Yeah.
So why would the Trill Council ever be surprised that a non-pure Trill would be able to hold a symbiote?
I was about to say, like, there would have to be so few pure Trill left in the galaxy at this point.
Well, and that's what they establish, is that it's like, that's what they're arguing over, right, Michael? Like, hey, there's so few of us left, it's all a gift. And the one is like, you know, we have to change our ways. And the other one's like, no, our religion won't let us. And then, no. And then the one's like, maybe we should just let it happen. And then they're like, okay.
So anyway, somehow Michael Burnham, who is pure human, is able to completely interface with all the Trill symbiote memories. And I she's able to get into the mindscape and solve the problem and save the symbiote's memories and make everyone happy.
And it looks like a Sega CD full motion video game with how bad the sort of tentacly water effects are.
Yeah.
And what it, Burnham shouldn't have been in there at all. Like, at all. Burnham should have been standing on the outside trying, like, fighting people or trying to stop people from getting in while she was under the water. And it should have been explained that the only reason she was able to survive is that the Trill symbiote had an emotional connection to her because it belonged to her significant other. Like, the whole idea of, like, that maybe that Trill symbiote was purposely trying its best to keep her alive during this. But they don't do that.
What can I say? This episode had a lot of good things in it. Well, I won't say a lot of it. It had good things in it, but it's, again, baffling. Just utterly baffling. Like, the weird choices, the kind of counterintuitive stuff that characters just start acting in weird ways. Like the Trill are completely xenophobic at this point. Don't want this human Trill symbiote mix on the planet. But after Michael's able to save them, they're totally okay with becoming a part of the Federation if it ever, comes back. Hey, you guys are welcome here.
They're like, yeah. Please stay with us. We need to study you and all this. It's like, no. I think I'm being told that I should go with them. That's my mission. And that's where they're like, no, you're going to stay with us so we can figure out why this worked. since apparently we didn't think it was possible, we should study you for, you know, several weeks so that we can then maybe find other hosts. But they're like, nah, I'm going to go in space where I'm probably going to die. And I mean, it's yeah. And then I'm more excited about the cameos for the next episode than I am for what's happened so far.
Pretty much.
But you've been pretty silent, Michael. And what about you? What do you think?
I'm interested to see why he's here. I'm wondering if the next episode is going to be like they find a cabal of ex-Federation scientists that have been locked up in like a think tank for like 100 years.
No, I think they're fine. That's the actual Federation. And that's when they find out. That's when they find out they're evil. And what they're going to have to do is then break away and find the small sleeper cell sects of real Federation supporters. And that's where we're going to find some previous actors that have been in Star Trek that magically found them way into the future. We're going to find like Barclay or something stupid in it. But it was interesting.
Robert Ricardo as a hologram again or something.
No, no, it'll be Andy Dick as the other hologram. Yes. it'll
could be work. Carrot Top or something.
Carrot Top the hologram? Well, oh my god. No, it'll be they'll bring no, they can't afford The Rock anymore. He can't play the champion. Why don't they just find like a Krenim ship so they can use it to go back in time and start erasing people and just erase all these bad things? But no, like they showed a preview of I guess somebody that they meet initially at what appears to be Starfleet, and that is played by Oded Fehr from the Mummy movies and Resident Evil movies. Good character actor. If you've ever seen a TV show called Sleeper Cell, he's really good in it. He usually plays either a sidekick good character or a terrorist in almost everything he's in. So I'm pretty sure he's playing a terrorist in this one. And then one frame at the very end, it's David Cronenberg, the famous horror director, out of nowhere. So I would be very interested to see if he directed an episode, but if anything, it would probably be a short trek. And I would be very interested to see what kind of crazy body horror he does. It wouldn't be good Trek. Wait, wasn't he on board? Wasn't he supposed to direct like Star Trek VI or something? Or no, he was supposed to direct, was it Empire Strikes Back? Or Dune or something? No. It was something crazy big that he was supposed to do. And then they're like, nah, because all your movies end up being like NC-17. So they just didn't do it. But like for... I was trying to figure out why they would cast him, because he's only acted in like three things. One of them being like Jason X, but he's an Academy nominated director, and just to have him randomly look, he looks to be the head of Starfleet from what I can see.
He's either the head of Starfleet or he's like Section 31. And that's why Giorgio is sitting there.
Yeah, that's probably more likely.
Like maybe this sect of Starfleet is Section 31 taking over in the space of Starfleet, and that's why they're like evil and can't be trusted.
Yeah, probably. And then if that's the case, then Oded Fehr's character will probably be evil to start, but then you find out he's actually a good guy and leaves with them.
Yeah.
And then because it'll be revealed that David Cronenberg is trying to horrify the universe by using teleportation fly monsters or something.
Yeah, just about.
So I guess, do we have any kind of closing thoughts on this? Because we've been going on a while.
Yes, and, sorry. Optimistic for what's happening, but yeah, as bad as we've been, you know, tearing this shit apart, we're tearing it apart, honestly, less than I think we probably thought we were going to.
I think it's got potential.
It just depends on where they go with it.
Yeah, like Alex is kind of like, he's kind of had me pivoted a certain way. Like, it's like, if you think of this, like, again, because I've been in the Stargate mood recently, think of it like that in a sense, and you'll enjoy it a lot more. And I'm thinking, you know what? You're not wrong, because they are doing new things each and every week. And it's not as fun as SG-1 is, for example. And as long as it's not the Michael Burnham show, it can be really good. But I don't want them, like, I want other crew members to shine. I want to see more in different stories. I want to see more in different backgrounds. I want to know this crew. I knew things about like half the crew on Voyager before the end of this, before the end of the first season. I knew that Tom Paris hung out in the holodeck a shit ton. I knew Ensign Kim played the clarinet. I knew all these little things.
Well, we know more about Lower Decks than we do this.
Yeah, I didn't know Detmer's name until season three.
In Enterprise, you learned more about the crew in the two-part pilot than you've learned in three seasons.
Yeah.
So a little less flash, a little more character. Like, Star Trek to me has always been about, like, exploration, but character. These are stories about people that happen in space, and there is a fantastical element to it, but they're human stories at the end of the day. Some of these episodes are just action piece after action piece. I think if they do more character focused things, we're going to be a lot more satisfied. But I'm enjoying Discovery season three that I enjoyed the entirety of Picard season one.
You liked when they made a pizza and
when Seven of Nine vaporized a guy.
And that was for the wrong reasons. You were like, what? But like genuinely you liked when they ate a pizza. And that was it, like genuinely liked. I went back and rewatched when I got the Blu-ray, and I still like the short treks better, and that's not saying much.
Obviously, I'm pretty down on the Star Trek elements of Discovery season three. There aren't Star Trek elements, or what Star Trek elements that they try to put in are just counterintuitive or stupid. I just can't get behind any kind of show that asks you to literally turn off your brain in order to believe plot happening the way it is. Asking you outside the show that this is, you know, this is here for Star Trek fans. Star Trek fans that want to think about plot, that want to think about news or moral quandaries or scientific exploration, and it's completely shitting on that all the time.
We might have to do I don't know if you guys all have Disney Plus like Mike and I have, but we might have to do a Mandalorian episode. Just
I'd be down for that. I actually watch it, and it's actually not as bad as I thought. There are some episodes where I feel like it's kind of like it drags, but overall, between the production value and the consistency, it's pretty spot on.
It's only 8 episodes per season, and they operate under the less is more, in that they don't try to go out of their way to write contrived stories. It's a little more sparsely written, and you fill in the blanks yourself. It's interesting because season two so far of what they've aired is actually very similar in plot to what's happening this season in Discovery. And I'll stay with me while I sort of explain that. In that this season so far, it has been, they have found a young officer that is in the Trill person, and they tried to return that Trill to its own tribe, and they're trying to find their own in a galaxy that's fallen apart. Well, season two is literally taking the little passenger trying to go through the exact same thing, trying to find its own tribe, only handled very differently, with much better emotion, and something that Star Trek hasn't seen in years, a little thing called subtlety. And a lot of show me, don't tell me. And they actually have things like panning shots, a shot that lasts more than 3 seconds before flashing to the next thing. Also really good scenery, also better acting. It's kind of interesting to see how they're running at the same time. And I think they cost about the same to make, which is insane to me because they look very different. But yeah, it'll be interesting to sort of maybe do that, because they're not, and they're also not full hour episodes. Like, I almost feel like sometimes Discovery's episodes go on longer than they need to just because they can, with the scripts of The Mandalorian. They range anywhere from 36 minutes to 48. It's whatever the script dictates. So yeah, maybe something we'll do in, you know, once everything's done in the new year.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched Mandalorian the first season, and I loved it. I thought it was great. It was well written. It was entertaining. It kept me interested.
But we'll save that review until we actually get around to watching it and reviewing it.
Yeah, like, I can talk. I'm, Alex knows I'm a huge Mandalorian mark, and I can talk about it endlessly. Like, I pick up on the Easter eggs. I'm like, that came from the role-playing game in 1992, because I know the page that's on.
What was that that I heard? Did I hear you whisper canon and lore?
Yeah, I know. It's wonderful. And they don't fuck it over. But anyway, that's a conversation for a different day. So thank you to everybody who has enjoyed this catharsis over Star Trek Discovery Season 3. Hopefully you've had a lot of fun with us.
Hey, we liked some of it. We liked some of it, which we can't say about the last two seasons.
Exactly. So hopefully things will continue on an upward trend. We'll see what surprises they have in store on It's the Michael Burnham Show. So anyway, thank you for joining us. So for This Week in Geek and the Geekcast Radio Network, we have been leading the fleet.
Steve Megatron Phillips.
In charge of the fastest garbage scow in the galaxy.
Alex, I don't have anything special to say.
Memory Alpha himself.
Aaron Pollier.
And I've been Mike the Birdman saying, live long and prosper.